everyone, what's going on? Welcome to a brand new edition of the Sam Bissell Podcast on the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And right now, I'm going to be bringing you the latest and greatest going on around the world of Hollywood. Hope everyone is having a wonderful week so far. A lot of stuff is already going on around the world of Hollywood that I want to dive into on this show today. It's Tuesday already, and there's still a whole lot of stuff. There's a whole week left to go, but there's a lot of jam-packed news for us to get to. I'm going to be talking about CinemaCon specifically this week is going on, which is basically when a lot of theater exhibitioners go to Las Vegas and basically they go to their own kind of little con basically, and they go kind of see what studios are going to be presenting them. So they get exclusive new footage and trailers and announcements. And so that's really a lot where the bulk of the news is happening. And so last night, Monday night, was when the Sony Pictures panel was happening. So we're going to be talking about everything that came out of there. I'm also going to be getting into this weekend's box office and, of course, recapping what came out on top, which we kind of know what did come out on top, but how everything else kind of fell in to the top 10. I also want to talk about some other things that went on as well, specifically some new details regarding one of the potentially the bigger summer films coming out this year, Mission Impossible 7. We're finally getting some new details in regards to that film. There's also some new details and images in regards to another highly anticipated summer movie season film, which is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. So we're going to get into all of that and so much more around the world of Hollywood. But the first thing that I do want to talk about, as I usually like to do, whether it's on Monday or on Tuesday, is recap the Sunday night beforehand, specifically when it comes to HBO's Succession. And this week it was episode 5 that came out on Sunday, and it was titled Kill List. And again, this is going to be a non-spoiler review for this latest episode of Succession. But the only thing that I will point out is that we finally get to see Alexander Skarsgård come back once again as Lucas Madsen in this episode. And we finally get to see more kind of the wheeling and dealing that it comes to, especially with the Roy siblings. And I've really kind of run out of things to say about this show. I mean, it's just been on another level. Specifically, this season has just been incredible. I mean, every single episode has not really maybe outdone itself, but it's just been able to just be consistently great. And it feels like when you look back on even going to episode 2, it feels like a decade ago. It feels like you've been on this crazy journey that we're only halfway through and we still have the back half of this final season to get to. But I think this specific episode, I think it was a great tension in the kind of wheeling and dealing that goes on when it comes to kind of these big, massive negotiations when it comes to kind of these acquisitions. And I think the writing in this episode did a great job of kind of fleshing out the Madsen character a lot more, because I think in season 3 it was cool to see Skarsgård in that character, but we only got kind of the outer part of him per se. We didn't really get to really dive into him. He was kind of an enigma a little bit. We didn't know really what to make of him, and we kind of felt that same way in the first half of the season. But by the 5th episode, we really dive into this character and how he kind of is similar in the very kind of weirdness that he kind of relate to, I think, with all the Roys and the people that have this kind of power within their own companies, whether they're titans in their own industry or they're very rich, wealthy people. And I think we really kind of peel back the layers, and there's a lot of weird stuff, and there's some things in there where you say maybe he's not the best kind of person, and you start to kind of question who he is a little bit. So I think they did a really good job of focusing on the Madsen character a lot in this episode and giving the audience a good idea of who he is. And I think going forward, it's going to be really interesting to see more of this character and the dynamic that he has with these Roy siblings, especially with the matriarchy out of the picture now, how he's dealing with these siblings now and how he kind of looks at them compared to how he looked at Logan Roy specifically at the end of season 3. And I also have to give a shout out, and I've been doing this to a lot of the actors throughout the season, whether it be Sarah Snook, Jeremy Strong, Brian Cox, Alan Ruddock for his portrayal as Connor Roy, especially in the first couple of episodes. But really, the one that has kind of gone under the radar this season so far, and he's done a really good job, and I think it showcases the evolution of the character, is Kieran Culkin as Roman Roy. And I think he did an exceptional job alongside the three siblings in episode 3. He was very good in episode 1, 2, and 4, but really, he gets his kind of Emmy moment in this episode, and who knows, maybe he gets another one or two or three in the last five episodes to come. But specifically, when you look back on just the first five episodes, everyone has their kind of Emmy moment so far, if you were just kind of put it in their reel or their highlight. And this episode showcased that for Kieran Culkin, especially in the last 10 minutes or so of this episode. And I thought he was magnificent. And I think between him and Sarah Snook, and I remember saying this after the season three finale aired a couple years ago, was that the MVPs for me that came out of that season were Sarah Snook and Kieran Culkin, because they were very good in season one and two, and their characters were kind of in the wings, but they really had a chance to blossom and grow, and you really got to showcase the talent of these actors in that third season. And especially with Sarah Snook, I think it's just more reinforcement, especially with that third episode. And hopefully there's more reinforcement just showcasing how great of an actor Kieran Culkin is, and how great and how amazing the arc of Roman Roy has kind of come throughout these four seasons so far. And I really love what he was able to do. So they're the ones that I really want to point out. And again, this was an amazing episode. I've run out of really things to say overall about the show just because it's been that great so far. But we still have five more episodes to go. Anything can happen, and I think it's setting itself up for a really interesting endgame for the back half of this season. So we still got a long way to go, but I like where we are at the halfway point of this season. What did you guys think about episode 5 of season 4 of Succession? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And now to move away from the TV corner of the podcast, to move on over to a lot of movie news that is going on around Hollywood. And again, there's a lot of stuff to get into, and we're going to dive into, again, something that I also like talking about at the beginning of each week, and that, of course, is the box office recap. And this weekend, I said it last week when talking about previewing what was coming out in theaters and on streaming, that really there's nothing in terms of big box office four quadrant films that's going to be going up against Super Mario Brothers, and it's very much so more counter programming that is kind of dishing itself out over these next couple of weeks. And that again turned into those results again for the third straight weekend for the Super Mario Brothers film, as it did come out number one on top the box office once again. It grossed $59 million for its third weekend and now has $436 million domestically, an additional $439 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $875 million at the box office. And again, when we look at the Super Mario Brothers film, it's just absolutely incredible to see the legs that this film has had. It only took a 35% dip from even its second weekend drop, which was still an incredible a small percentage drop from its opening weekend, which was huge, to what it was able to do its second weekend, now onto its third weekend. And with this, it continues to break a bunch of records. So along with this third weekend for an animated film, it is the third best weekend overall for an animated movie. And previously before that, it was The Incredibles 2, which came out in 2018, which had $46.4 million in its third weekend at the box office. Overall, when we count and take into account the third best weekends overall, it comes in at number 7, just behind Avengers Infinity War, which came out at 62. Then it was Avengers Endgame at 63. Coming in above that was Black Panther with 66.3, of Avatar The Way of Water, which when you count it's at the end of 2022 into 2023, it came out on top with $67.4 million. Then right above that is the first Avatar film, which came in at $68.4 million, and then way ahead of the crowd, which is going to be very hard to beat for any third weekend, I think, going forward. And still at that mark is the 2015 film, of course, Star Wars The Force Awakens, which is also still currently the highest grossing domestic film of all time as well. So that, I think, the way that box office tracked and the way that film came out, it's going to be tough to really just kind of beat that overall. But the fact that the Super Mario Brothers film is able to even get into that same category within just the top 10 of third best weekends with those live action behemoths is still an amazing feat. And then when you take into account the fact that Mario is overall with its domestic total, it's made over $400 million domestically. It is the second fastest animated film to do that, just at 18 days. And the previous record holder was, or still right now, is Incredibles 2, which is at 15 days. So it wasn't able to beat that. But again, the fact that it is able to do this right now, I think, showcases is the incredible margin for the IP. And when you take into account with Universal, who partnered on this with Nintendo, it is the third highest grossing Universal title of all time at the domestic box office with that $434 million. Number one is still Jurassic World, which came out in 2015 with $653.4 million. So it still has some ways to go for that, but again, I think it's going to be able to do just that. And then in terms of the rankings of the domestic box office chart right now, when you look at the fact that it's at $434 million, it still has to go over the likes of Shrek 2, the Frozen films. Incredibles is still the highest grossing animated film domestically with over $600 million. But again, when you look at the when you look at what Mario has been able to do so far and being the only true big film in town right now, even though kids and young adults are going back to school right now, people are still going to the movies with their families to see this film. And with these numbers, it showcases the repeat viewing is there, that you're not going not once, but twice, three times, four times even maybe to see this movie. And it's showing and paying off for this film. And it's only really a matter of time before it hits that $1 billion mark for worldwide grosses. I would probably think next weekend, maybe the weekend after that, the beginning of the May, it's able to do that because it still has to hit in markets like Japan, which Nintendo is huge over there, especially Mario. One of Mario is one of the bigger IPs from Nintendo that's huge there. And if it's able to cross without that market and you still have the possibility of those markets doing very well, it's going to be a very, very good, it's already a good run for Mario, but it's just going to add even more so to that total. And it's going to be one of the highest grossing films of all time. Is it going to be the highest grossing film? I don't know about that just yet. It's, I think it'll definitely end up in the top five probably when all is said and done. But I think, again, like I said last week, the week before, Universal has new IP to go into, and it's untapped gold mine that this IP can really become, whether it's sequels, spin-offs, or whether it's new IP within the Nintendo universe, when you're going to things like Zelda or some of these other iconic characters within that landscape, I think is going to do very, very, very well for itself, and the results are just showing. So once again, Super Mario Brothers is still breaking records at the box office, and it's still, I think, going to be number one for at least one more weekend. We have, this is the last weekend of April, and of course, next weekend is going to be when the unofficial start of the summer movie season begins, when Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 hits theater. So that'll probably when it takes its foot off of the number one ranking and probably dips down, whether it's the two or three, and Guardians will probably take that top spot, especially since it'll be taking the IMAX, the Dolby screens that right now Mario has a hold over, because again, there's really nothing else that is out right now other than Bo's Afraid, which is nowhere near the behemoth that Mario is, but it still has some IMAX theaters. But overall, Mario still has the overall release and size of the premium level format screenings, but will be overtaken by Guardians next weekend. So at least one more weekend for Mario to collect a lot of money before the Guardians take over and probably institute their own dominance at the box office to begin the summer movie season. Then coming in at number two this weekend was Evil Dead Rise, which grossed $24.5 million at the box office. Domestically, it has $24 million. Of course, it also has an international total of $17.9 million for a worldwide total of $42 million worldwide at the box office. And once again, as a tale as old as time, especially over the last couple of years with the pandemic, really, I think it's really kind of driven home the studios that horror is the genre of the moment right now. And even though comic book films still do really well, I think over the last couple of months, year or so, it's been a little kind of shaky in terms of the financial success of some of these movies, what you deem could be a failure, what could be a modest hit, a big hit. For the most part, 9 times out of 10, horror has been absolutely consistent. And it really kind of showcases on Evil Dead Rise that it doesn't matter what the IP is, If it's got scary moments in there, if it's got really good reviews potentially, people will go see those movies. And then when you're able to expand beyond the niche horror fan, you're going to be able to do really, really well. And also what goes to attribute to a horror movie is the fact that a lot of these films come in on low budgets. And Evil Dead Rise, for example, is one of those films that came in on a more of a modest budget than per se maybe $80, $90 million budget, and you're going to have to kind of reap some rewards. So for a film like Evil Dead Rise, which makes $24 million at the box office, you're over exceeding those expectations, which initial projections had it at around $20 million. So because of that lower budget, you're going to be able to raise the ceiling for the film to do really well, which is kind of the Blumhouse bread and butter, per se, of what that studio is able to do, where low budget films, higher reward for their box office intake. So when they make $100 million, that's a runaway success. That's like if a superhero film or a blockbuster film were to basically make $1 billion at the box office. That's what it kind of equates to. I'm not saying that Evil Dead Rise is going to do that, but I do think that it's going to have itself a good run here, especially if it's able to kind of leg itself out. And from all the reviews that I've heard so far, it's done really, really well. And specifically with Evil Dead, that is also coming from a franchise. So you get the franchise fans in there, along with the horror fans, along with people that might just be interested in wanting to go see a horror film right now. If there's nothing else out there that is kind of tickling them to go see other than this, then I think you're going to get people that want to go see. You're going to get that young adult demographic. You're going to get some of the maybe 30, 35, 40-year-olds also go see this film as well. So you have a good formula mixing for you. And what's also great about the Evil Dead Rise story, along with exceeding expectations, is that it also kind of went the route of kind of Smile in a way, where while that one was kind of tested in screen and went from streaming to theatrical, Warner Brothers Discovery now, with their new management in place, is very much taken on the mentality of theatrical first no matter what. So they've been kind of turning a lot of their what would have been straight to streaming films like an Evil Dead Rise go from that to theaters, and it's paying off for them. And while some of their other films haven't done that, Evil Dead Rise was able to turn at least the beginning of what could be a profit for Warner Brothers, and at least gave them a good opening weekend to feel confident about. And again, we look at films like Smile, Black Phone, even Cocaine Bear, which wasn't the kind of success that a Smile or Black Phone was, but I think it's still going to do, again, modestly well for itself given the budget, even though it has a CGI bear. I think it just goes to show that consistently, financially speaking, horror is the way to go right now. And I think you're going to see more studios put more, not per se money, but more investment into the horror genre, especially if it is going to be successful for them. And because of the money that you're putting into some of these budgets, you can go in on a lower budget cost and allow more quantity into the marketplace. And I think when it's a good film and people want to be scared, they will go see it. And I think this was one of those examples. And I think Evil Dead Rise is going to have a really good run for itself right now, especially since there isn't really a big horror film coming out in the next couple of weeks. So even with the summer movie season coming into effect, I think horror is going to be able to be good counter programming to some of these bigger films that are coming out as well. So when you have a Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 coming out, even though that's going to probably step on some of the success of Super Mario Brothers next weekend, I do think that you're still going to get fans and people that would want to rather maybe go see something horror than go see a comic book film. So I think this is going to be very good counter programming for the next couple of weeks to come. And for Warner Brothers, who have kind of been off to a little bit of a rocky start to begin the year with films like House Party and Shazam Fury of the Gods didn't really do so well, and Magic Mike's The Last Dance didn't do so well at the box office. This is, in terms of opening weekend especially, this is their first big win of the year, and I'm sure they're hoping that it isn't their last win of the year as they get into what should be a very lucrative summer movie season for them as well. So they came in at number two this weekend with Evil Dead Rise. Then coming in at number three is the Jake Gyllenhaal, Guy Ritchie film The Covenant, which grossed $6.3 million at the box office. It did not come out in any of the international markets, so its domestic total is also the worldwide total. And this film fell right into line with what projections had for it, and that is exactly what I think you can expect for this kind of a war film, especially coming from Guy Ritchie, Jake Gyllenhaal, who, even though he's a name, and I think people recognize the name, unfortunately, and I feel like this, he's very underrated in this way, that people don't go see his films the same way that they would maybe go see a Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, or even a Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And I think Jake Gyllenhaal has that kind of star power, but because of that, it wasn't able to kind of get into the range. I think it could over exceed, but I think for MGM, I think they're fine with this opening weekend. It's just, again, going to be very interesting to see with this opening weekend. People went to go see the film. It's got great reviews and it got a great cinema score. I think the best of all the new big releases that came out this weekend. I believe it came in with an A cinema score, so it's got the best reviews coming out in terms of word of mouth. But I don't know who's going to come out and see this film. I did see it over the weekend. I thought it was great. I would recommend people to watch it, but I feel like this film is one that could probably do better on VOD and probably in the digital market than in theaters. Not to say that I would want to take it out of theaters, but I think it's best solution of in terms of financial likability is doing it more on streaming on VOD than in theaters. But maybe this film is able to have some really good legs and hold out for itself in the next couple of weeks. But it didn't overperform, didn't underperform. I think it was right in line with what projections had for this new film from Guy Ritchie, which was The Covenant. Then coming in at number four this weekend is one of the big holdovers from the month of March, which was John Wick Chapter 4, which grossed an additional $5.8 million at the box office. It now has $168 million at the domestic box office, $189 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $358 million at the box office. And it is still, as of right now, the highest grossing worldwide total of the John Wick films right now. It still has, I think, some ways to go for the domestic total to get there, but I think very much so John Wick Chapter 4, it's on its way to eclipsing that potentially in the next couple of weeks. Then coming in at number five is Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, which grossed an additional $5.5 million at the box office and now has $82 million domestically, $95 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $178 million at the box office. Then coming in to round out the bottom half of the top 10 is number six, which comes in with Air, the Ben Affleck directed film, which grossed an additional $5.4 million at the box office, and now has $41 million domestically, $27 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $68 million at the box office. And again, I've been saying the last couple of weeks, I think that's a really good number for this film, especially coming out from a streaming service company like Amazon. And I'm sure in the next couple of months, they will be getting this film onto Amazon Prime Video. But the reason that I think in terms of financiability in the box office is because I think if this was, again, a $30, $40 million film, they'd be looking more towards potentially getting a profit off of this film just theatrically before it even hits streaming. But because of its higher budget cost, which is around $80, $90 million, box office-wise, I don't think it's going to be able to turn a profit. However, though, I think for Amazon, that was not the case. And so I think in turn for them, they're looking to maybe recoup that money back when it hits their streaming service in terms of the viewers that they're able to gain from the eyeballs on their service. So this, I think in the end, even though it's in terms of box office profit, it's going to turn in a negative cost, I think. Overall, I actually think it's an overall win for the company, because between Creed 3, which did very well at the box office, and then a film like this, which again is a higher mid-budget movie release that is not based off of any IP, but it just great overall movie filmmaking at its finest, with really big stars like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and Viola Davis, and a really interesting subject material, which is about Michael Jordan basically in basketball. So I think overall, even though it's going to probably not turn a profit theatrically, when you take into account the streaming numbers in this one, I think it'll do very well for itself in the long run. And I think this is a good sign that Amazon will have confidence in their continued ability to put more films theatrically before putting them on on their streaming service. Then coming out at number 7 this weekend was The Pope's Exorcist, which grossed an additional $3.4 million at the box office and now has made $15 million at the domestic box office, $37 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $52 million. Then coming in at number 8 is the Nicolas Cage, Nicholas Hoult, Dracula film Renfield, which grossed an additional $3.2 million at the box office and now has $13 million domestically, $4 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $18 million at the box office. Coming in at number 9 is the Ari Aster-directed Joaquin Phoenix-led film Bo is Afraid, which grows an additional $2.8 million and now has $3.1 million at the domestic box office. And because it has not come out in any international markets, its worldwide total also is its total domestically as well. So $3.1 million for Bo is Afraid. And even though it did very well for itself coming out of a per theater average for only screening at 4 films last weekend, the big challenge is going to be what it's going to be able to do for itself now that it's going to be expanding to over 900 theaters around the country for this film to be screened in. And while the numbers showcase a huge percentage increase, which will happen when you expand beyond 4 theaters, even though they're in the New York, LA market, it's more of a matter of a question of how much was it an increase of when you go past the per theater average. And when you look at the budget for this film, $2.8 million, I don't think it was really going to cut it for an expansion on their opening weekend. And I think the thing about Bo is Afraid is that it only is going to hit a certain market of people, whether they're Ari Aster fans, whether they're A24 people, or they're indie film people and they want to go support an artistic creative film like this one. And I just don't think it's going to be able to expand past the overall broader general audience. And I think a big part of that is going to be because of the word of mouth, the reviews that are coming out for this one. So I just don't think overall it's going to be able to make a profit off of this. But to get into the top 10 is pretty cool, but I just don't think overall it's going to resemble a profitable win for A24 this time around. Coming then, rounding out, of course, the top 10 this weekend was the film Shazimi, which grossed $1.6 million at the box office and now has $8 million domestically, $150 million internationally, for a worldwide total of $158 million at the box office. And then the other film that also came out this weekend, it only came in at around 100,000 or really kind of 1,200 theaters or so, was the Searchlight Picture film Chevalier, which of course was with Kevin Harrison Jr. and Samara Weaving, and it didn't do particularly that well, which is not all that surprising, and hasn't really kind of gained any traction, so that one comes in below the top 10. But to go through the top 10 once again, from 10 to 1, we have number 10 being Shazimi, number 9 being Bo is Afraid, number 8 being Renfield, number 7 being The Pope's Exorcist, number 6 being Air, number 5 being Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves, number 4 being John Wick Chapter 4, number 3 being The Covenant, or rather Guy Ritchie's The Covenant, number 2 is Evil Dead Rise, and then once again, for the third straight weekend, reigning in as a number 1 champion, of course, is the Super Mario Brothers movie. So what did you guys think about the box office this weekend? Were there films that you were hoping to make the box office that didn't? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. Now to move on to some big movie news that has come out over the last couple of days. And I want to continue by talking about one of the bigger films coming out this summer movie season that I think is going to have a lot of people excited about, especially coming off of the wave that was Top Gun Maverick last year, which was also with Tom Cruise. And of course, this summer we have another Tom Cruise vehicle. And that, of course, is the 7th installment in the Mission Impossible franchise, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. And the only kind of promo that we've really gotten for the film is that trailer that came out almost a year ago when Top Gun Maverick was hitting theaters, which was smart for Paramount to do, especially when you have a Tom Cruise movie coming out and there was all this wave of great buzz and response coming out for it, that it made sense for Paramount to say, hey, if you want to check out Tom Cruise ad for this, be on the lookout for his next film, which is coming out next summer in this new Mission Impossible film. But really, other than that, we've gotten some updates from Christopher McQuarrie, who is the writer and director director of not just part one and part two of these new Mission films, but he's also worked on the previous two Mission Impossible films, Rogue Nation and Fallout, which are the fifth and sixth installments of the franchise. But other than getting some social media posts from Christopher McQuarrie about some of the locations that they were a part of and that they've been filming at, and of course that big stunt that we've seen Tom Cruise do where he's basically riding a motorcycle off of a cliff, which is insane, and it's kind of dubbed the biggest stunt in cinema history. Other than that, we don't know anything else about kind of the characters, where we're seeing some returning characters kind of pop up, where they are now, some of these new characters. We have no idea who they're playing. It's a great ensemble lineup that includes Tom Cruise returning along with Rebecca Ferguson. You also have Vin Rames coming back. You have the likes of Hayley Atwell joining this franchise. You have Plom Klementov. Isai Morris is coming in playing the villain in this one, but we don't know who any of these characters are really and what the story is really going to be focused on with this. Well, Entertainment Weekly was able to come in to kind of start off the week yesterday and shed not a whole lot of light, but just peek under the covers just a tad little bit and offer some new images and information in regards to this new film. So in terms of the photos that Entertainment Weekly had, there are a few of them that were kind of interesting. We have one that includes Tom Cruise with newcomer Hayley Atwell. It seems like it's going to be from that big kind of buggy car chase sequence that we're going to get in the film, where it seems like they might be handcuffed to one another and both doors are kind of blown off at this point and they're kind of just driving through. Then, of course, we have an image of Tom Cruise reuniting with Fallout star Vanessa Kirby. And then, of course, there's one kind of behind-the-scenes one, or there's another one with the IMF crew, and then there's one behind the scenes where it seems like it's Christopher McQuarrie and Tom Cruise kind of going over the bike stunt sequence that, of course, we saw that featurette with when Avatar The Way of Water came out. But, again, other than that, there's nothing really else to kind of take away from it. And then, also, we got a new shot of Plom Klementov and her new character, which was kind of kept under the wraps a little bit. But in terms of the images, they look really cool, they look really nice, but again, not giving away a whole lot in terms of what we're going to be seeing with this film. And I found what was really interesting that when they did have a little bit of an interview with Christopher McQuarrie, who was able to give a little bit of tidbits about the film, and he kind of talked about shooting on locations for a lot of this shoot, specifically in England, Abu Dhabi, Norway. He also talked about how really we've had a lot of films kind of come out during the COVID-19 pandemic that shot during the pandemic, especially in the height of it, just when it was kind of in its original kind of infancy in 2020, 2021. And you had films like Jurassic World Dominion, where they were really kind of one of the first big blockbusters to film in isolation, really, and kind of carry forth with a big production like that during the true kind of peak height of the pandemic during that time frame. And so there was a lot of buzz being made about that film. But one of the other films that really kind of came out during the 2020 kind of phase of the pandemic was the Mission Impossible films. And Christopher McQuarrie kind of talks about how they were basically in Italy, which was kind of the hot zone for the pandemic at that time in early February, January of 2020, and how they were right about the shoot, and then all of a sudden the pandemic hit and they had to shut down. But really, once they decided to ramp back up again, whereas Jurassic World Dominion was very much kind of in, I think, one kind of location for the most part, Mission Impossible, both films right now, 7 and 8, were very much these kind of globe-trotting films. So they were kind of just going about kind of being as isolated as they possibly could while traveling the world shooting these films. And he's still shooting this film right now, specifically the 8th one, but they've been kind of interchanged with one another throughout the last couple of years, and he's been working on them for the better half of this decade right now in terms of trying to get these off the ground. So to kind of hear his perspective on all this was really, really interesting, and the kind of the trials and tribulations of making this film during the pandemic and kind of throughout the ups and downs of the pandemic and then now coming out of it. And it's kind of interesting to see all those phases being put into both of these films right now. And so I think it was really kind of interesting to see him kind of talk about that and utilizing a worldwide production. And then he also kind of talked about some of the new characters that we're going to be getting in this movie, specifically about Plom Klementov's character, who she's going to have an amazing summer 2023 between Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 and whatever character she's playing in this film, which hopefully we learn more about before the film comes out, or whether they want to keep it a mystery or not, it's up to them. But I'm really interested to see what she's going to do in the film. But from what McQuarrie says is that she is somebody who at the start of our story is partnered with Sai, who is the villain in this film, and represents this malevolent force that Ethan is opposed to. So that's just a little bit that we get for her character. But from the first trailer that came out, she looks like she gets to kind of be a part of the action, which is kind of really exciting. And then the other person that he talks about a lot is Hayley Atwell's character, who he doesn't really speak a whole lot about her as a character, but specifically more about why he wanted to include Hayley Atwell. And it seems like he's been wanting to include her since Rogue Nation, basically saying in the article that they wanted to have her be in Rogue Nation. They weren't able to kind of work anything out there. Schedules didn't really align. And then somehow during the midst of the pandemic and everything, they were able to kind of align everything together. And she's a big part of this film, or both of these films, it seems like. So it's absolutely amazing to see. And when you also talk about the nature of the pandemic and everything that happened, Hayley Atwell was on set, according to McQuarrie, for over 100 days, and she didn't have her first dialogue scene until well over those 100 days. So she was kind of on set just being there, being part of the action, just because of the isolation of it all, and because they wanted to keep everything as bubbled as they can, kind of being their own traveling performance show in a way. They had her on set for as long as they possibly could, and so just to kind of be there for that amount of time and then not have any dialogue until after that is amazing. And so I'm really curious to hear more about those stories as press begins to roll out for the movie, and whether it's at CinemaCon this week, when we probably will hear more about the filming and hear about more footage from the movie when Paramount does their own presentation later this week, or whether it's for the premiere in July. Whenever the film comes out, I'm really interested to hear from him and the production of really what went into this movie and how they were able to pull off both films, which they're still filming right now. And I think it's going to be one that when we find out the details that they want us to find out, it's going to be amazing to kind of see how it all kind of came together and kind of held together in the midst of everything that was really kind of going on. So I really like the images, hearing some of the new details, even though they weren't a whole lot, does still get me excited for this film. The only thing I really want at this point is a new trailer, because I love the one that we had and it still gets me excited, but I want to see new material. I want to see new footage. I want to see more of the action, more of the story of what we're getting in this film, and how we're going to see the IMF team go up against whatever enemy they're going to go up against, and to kind of see all the areas that they go into. I'm really excited about that. So it seems like we're going to be in for a really fun ride with Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. And honestly, this isn't my solid prediction, but it's one of the ones that I have formulating, and something that I wouldn't be surprised about is, wouldn't shock me if Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is the biggest film in the summer of 2023, because of everything with Top Gun Maverick, the momentum with Tom Cruise, the fact that this franchise, Fallout, Rogue Nation, all of them have increased their profit amount with each of their films. I think the franchise is at an all-time high right now. Tom Cruise is at an all-time high right now. And all that is, I think it's just working itself to really, really benefiting this movie when it comes out in July of this year, specifically July 14th. What did you guys think about these new images and details in regards to the new Mission Impossible film? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And then to go to another potentially big film coming out this summer movie season, the one that is going to kind of end June, begin July, in that nice sweet spot in the middle of the summer movie season, of course, is the fifth and final film in the Indiana Jones franchise, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And then, of course, thanks to the people over at Total Film, we have a bunch of new details in regards to this film, along with a few cool new photos that are out for this movie. So in terms of the photos, we have a new one that showcases kind of Indiana Jones and one of his sidekicks, or rather her goddaughter, really, in Helena Shaw, played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and which it seems like they're in Dubai or somewhere like that, in some kind of a market area, and you just kind of see them facing some kind of danger. So the photos themselves are really cool. But again, what I always love about these exclusives are the details, the behind the scenes stuff in terms of the making of this film and why it was a daunting task to get this film off the ground, and then why it took so long for them to work on it. And one of the things that they do discuss within the articles that we got from Total Film was that one of the things we've seen so far in the trailer that have just been jaw-dropping is the de-aging of Harrison Ford, who looks like, thanks to this amazing de-aging technology and kind of deep fake in a way, where we're able to kind of go back in time and see prime time Harrison Ford like it's the 80s again, like he hasn't aged in a day. And the material looks just absolutely incredible. And according to Total Film, in talking with James Mangold, apparently the de-aging, which we kind of heard about in previous interviews, but the one thing that is expanded upon is that this de-aging is going to be a part of the opening sequence. And apparently this isn't just going to be a 5 minute, 10 minute opening sequence. It's apparently going to be a 25 minute opening sequence to kick everything off with this film. And according to James Mangold, it has a lot to do with the tech, and this is what he had to explain about utilizing that tech and how it incorporates itself into the 25 minutes. He said, "I just shot him and he just pretended that he was 35, but the technology involved is a whole other thing. We had hundreds of hours of footage of him in close-ups, in mediums and wides, and every kind of lighting night and day. The advancement of the technology also came with additional benefits. I could shoot Harrison on a Monday, as you know, a 75-year-old playing a 35-year-old, and I could use dailies by Wednesday with his head already replaced. It wasn't a year of effort to get to a first pass. It was an incredible technology. And in many ways, I just didn't think about it. I was focused on shooting in what's approximately a 25-minute opening extravaganza that was my chance to just let it rip. The goal was to give the audience a full-body taste of what they missed so much, because then when the movie lands in 1969, they're going to have to make an adjustment to what it is now, which is different from what it was." So hearing that from James Mangold gets me excited, because I think, because Harrison Ford is 80 years old at this point, I mean, he is an old man at this point, he can't do the things that he used to do. So it's going to be interesting to see how they utilize Harrison Ford pretending he's back when he was that young in the 80s, really. And it's going to be really cool to see. And again, in the trailers, it looks pretty much seamless. And I think it was a smart idea to shoot it in the dark, at least from the trailers. It seems like it's very much in the dark, and it's, you don't have to have a whole lot of lighting behind it per se, although when they take off the mask, it seems like he is in front of a bunch of lighting. And even then, it looks, when you stop it and freeze frame it, it looks almost spotless at that point. So I just can't wait to see what they're going to do. And I like how he basically is saying, we're going to give you what you love about the character and then kind of put you in a totally new format in terms of flash forwarding to the end of the 60s into the 70s and showcasing a very older Indiana Jones. So it's not like we're not seeing Indiana Jones in his prime and he's older and we don't get to experience that anymore. He's giving us that. And I think that's going to be great to see. And it reminds me a lot of something like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where that, I remember that prologue, well, I don't think it was 20, 25 minutes. I'm going to have to go back and check, but I think it was around a 10, 15 minute prologue where we see a young River Phoenix play a teenage version of Indiana Jones, and it kind of fits into the plot of the beginning of the movie, and of course has certain threads that kind of lead into the overall story of the film between the father and between Sean Connery and Harrison Ford, father and son. And I don't know, I'm sure something like that is going to happen with this movie. But it just kind of, it reminds me of that again. So I'm excited to see what we're going to get with that 25-minute sequence. But then along with that information, we also got some new details in regard to Harrison Ford himself, who, again, is 80 years old. It's, you're soaking in as much as you possibly can. He's kind of having this, another kind of mini moment where he's not just in Indiana Jones again, but he's in great TV shows. He's in a Taylor Sheridan Yellowstone spinoff with Helen Mirren in 1923. He's in a well-renowned Apple TV Plus comedy with Jason Segel called Shrinking. So he's having this kind of mini moment again where we're seeing not just Harrison Ford a few times here and there. He's in our faces a lot right now, which is great. I mean, we have to appreciate Harrison Ford as much as we can right now. And for him, he's even said in terms of Indiana Jones, even though, of course, with this franchise, you can probably go in multiple new movies, multiple TV shows. And I remember at one point there was a rumor of doing an Indiana Jones TV show. But in terms of Harrison Ford playing the character, it's been speculated, it's been talked about that this is going to be the final Indiana Jones film. And again, in this interview with Total Film Magazine, he basically put the kibosh on everything else, basically stating that yes, indeed, this is going to be my last time putting on the fedora hat and writing off as Indiana Jones. And this is specifically what he had to say, saying, "This is the final film in the series. This is the last time I'll play the character. I anticipate that it will be the last time that he appears in a film. I have been ambitious to do this film for 10 years, and there finally came a time when we all committed to that. It was a joyous moment for me. I think it's a rare situation that I find myself in. I've been able to deliver amazing films developed by Steven and George over a 40-year period, and to end it, not with a whimper, but with a bang, has been my greatest ambition for this excursion." And to me, when Harrison Ford talks about that, I think it's very significant, because all due respect to Star Wars fans and Han Solo, who is one of the great characters in cinema, but I think for Harrison Ford himself, and I think you could find it very apparent when he talks about it between The Force Awakens press, when he talked about his cameo in The Rise of Skywalker, I think he was always kind of done with Han Solo a little bit. I think he, even from the moment when he played him in Empire Strikes Back, he always wanted George Lucas to kill off the character. And he finally got his wish in The Force Awakens. I'm not going to say he had a disdain for the character, but I don't think it was a character that he always held to his heart, I think. I think he was fine with letting that character go and not playing it ever again. With Indiana Jones, just from everything that I've seen from him when he talks about this movie the last couple of years, this character specifically of Indiana Jones means a lot to him. And I think if he had a choice, obviously, between Han Solo and Indy, it seems like he has more an affection for Indiana Jones. And I think between last year's Star Wars celebration, where apparently when talking about the film, he got very emotional in the experience of making this film and everything that went into it, and then hearing him talking about in this interview kind of glowingly about having this ambition, this drive to give this character a great send-off. With Han Solo, he couldn't care too much about if he was stuck with a lightsaber or killed with a blaster. He couldn't care less. But with Indiana Jones, he cares about how this character is given some finality, some closure, and an ending arc to the films that he's been a part of. And I think he realizes that with Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, that wasn't the best way. If he wanted to end his tenure, that wasn't the best way to do it. And I think he realizes that with this film, and as long as it's taken it to do it, it seems like they've gotten it right with the director in place, with the story in place, with the cast, crew, that they've delivered something special. And I think he was committed to doing that. And I'm excited to see that side of Harrison Ford with his iconic characters. And again, with Han Solo, we never really saw it. In interviews, he could care less about theories and all that stuff. But with Indiana Jones, there's a love there for this character. And it comes across in every time he talks about it. And I'm excited to see this movie. The trailers have been amazing. Hearing about all this stuff seems great. I'm a big fan of James Mangold. And again, I said, if there's one, there's a few directors that you might be able to put in place of Steven Spielberg. A Martin Scorsese, maybe a Francis Ford Coppola if you're a big movie fanatic, or even a James Cameron, Chris Nolan maybe, but those guys would never do an Indiana Jones film. But if you wanted to find somebody that is a good replacement for Steven Spielberg, you can't get any better than James Mangold. And he's dealt with these kind of send-off final films. He did it as good as you possibly can in creating probably one of, if not the greatest comic book films of all time in some people's minds, in Logan, which gave Wolverine and that version of Hugh Jackman's character a great send-off, a great finality to it, and a great emotional arc that was different and cool and really amusing. And I think he's going to deliver that once again in this movie, and it's going to be exciting and cool, and it seems like they really delivered on a special, special film. We'll see if it's any special. I mean, if they're premiering at the Cannes Film Festival, Lucasfilm and Disney must feel like they have something really good up their sleeve if they're feeling good enough to world premiere it at that festival in that environment and deliver all the press to kind of start the media tour there and send Harrison Ford, send Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Mads Mikkelsen, everyone over there and kind of give that the first big impression for the film. So I'm really excited about it. We'll see how it all kind of lands, but it comes out June 30th, which, again, I think it's going to do really, really well. I know some people are a little on the fence, but I just think we'll have to see what the reactions are, but I think critically it'll do really well, and I do think it's going to do very, very, very well at the box office this year. I think people are going to be shocked by how well it does, but we'll have to wait and see. We're still about two and a half months away from it really kind of debuting for everyone to see in theaters, so we still got some time for that to actually happen. But what do you guys think about this new information in regards to Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the final two things that I want to talk about on the podcast, going on over from the world of the summer blockbuster season to the Academy Awards, and specifically to talk about next year's 96th annual Oscars. And we're not even a few months removed. It feels like we're more than a few months removed, but it's really been kind of just over a month, really, since the 95th Annual Academy Awards happened and Everything Everywhere All at Once just broke records left and right and had a huge night. Brendan Fraser, of course, won for Best Actor. It was a huge night and ended one award season, but then, of course, kind of opened up the pathway for next year's awards run for next year's Academy Awards. And one of the first indications for where we have for the Final Destination has now been given to us, as it was announced by the Academy that the date for the 96th Annual Academy Awards has been set and that those Oscars will air on ABC, specifically on March 10th. And they also gave a whole slew of dates in regards to the season itself when it came to voting periods, luncheon dates, and the ones to really kind of keep your eyes out are on for, and the one that I really want you to keep your eyes out on are the voting dates. So on Thursday, January 11th to Tuesday, January 16th is the window for nomination voting. So it'll begin at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and then it will end at around probably like 8-9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on January 16th. And then nominations will be announced that next week on Tuesday, January 23rd. And then we'll have basically a full month before the final voting begins. And then from when the final voting ends on February 27th, the Academy Awards will air on March 10th. And so we have the kind of the preliminary outline for what next award season is going to be like. And I know that in earlier Oscar years when they would telecast, it would be around March. But for me, when I was little too, I always had the Oscars on at the end of February. And I know that the pandemic kind of screwed that up a little bit from when it usually was, which is kind of crazy that in 2020, before the pandemic, that was the shortest date for an Oscars telecast on, I believe it was like February 9th, when that was the year that Parasite won. And then, of course, the year after was when the pandemic was in full effect. And then, of course, we had the longest one in Academy history when it premiered in April. But over the last year or two, we've kind of gotten back to some kind of normalcy, and it's hit right around that sweet spot of March 10th, which I think for all of award season is a little long. It's a little dragged out. I would have preferred it to be the last weekend of February, because for me, it would always be first weekend of February would be the Super Bowl, and then the last weekend of February would be the Oscars. And that to me was a great bookend, kind of beginning and end to the month of February for me, which has my birthday. It was a great month to celebrate the month of February overall. So for me, I would have still loved to kind of keep that February month for the Oscars, but it seems like the Academy has found that bubble within the beginning of March. And again, I think we don't know who's going to host, we don't know who's going to produce, but to have this preliminary outline, I think it will fill in the rest of the award season as it goes along. But again, one award season end is the reaps of another one beginning, and we're going to be starting out with another award season run that'll be heating up during the summer season. And then, of course, we have Cannes, we have Tribeca. Then, of course, we have the fall festival season, which is really going to when we see a lot of these kind of films, award level kind of films, really kick into high gear during that fall festival run. So before we know it, we're going to be talking about the 96th Annual Academy Awards. But right now, we're still kind of in the lull of not really kind of talking about it. But we get an idea of when we will have the end date for next year's award season run, which will be on March 10th when the 96th Annual Academy Awards Awards air on ABC on that date. What do you guys think about the Academy Awards airing on March 10th? Do you think that's a good date? Do you think it should be in February? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the final thing that I want to talk about on the podcast today is to kind of begin my recap of all the panels that came out in CinemaCon this week. Now, over the next couple of days, we're gonna have the Disney panel kind of come out. Earlier today was the Warner Brothers panel, which I'll speak more about either tomorrow or on Thursday. So over the next couple of days, I'll be recapping all the big panels that come out for CinemaCon. And to kind of give a little bit of a preface of what CinemaCon is, even though I kind of outlined it a little bit at the top of the show, basically what CinemaCon is you basically get a lot of the big and small theater exhibitions. It's not really for fans. It's really only theater exhibitioners and press go to Caesar's Palace, basically in Las Vegas, and basically the NATO, which is the North American Association of Theater Owners, basically all kind of come together and put on this big event that happens basically over a week's time, and basically each studio comes in kind of every day, or really every day, every night, and offers new details, new footage on all the films that are basically coming out over the next year or so, and kind of give their pitch to the studio, the studios give their pitch to the theater owners on why specifically they should have their films come out in theaters and why they should when it comes time to book films for screenings and for certain theaters and times and things like that. Why should those films get your business, and why should the theaters allow for your films to play in their complexes, basically? And that's really all it kind of is. But you don't really get a whole lot of announcements. It's not like Comic-Con or D23 or Star Wars Celebration where you get all these new crazy announcements. It's more about pitching the films that are currently coming out. And so I'll get into Warner Brothers a little bit later, but I know today when Warner Brothers panel was kind of coming out, it wasn't really much focused on even the future, talking about 2024 stuff. It very much focused on everything basically coming out for the rest of 2023, and that's what a lot of the studios are kind of gearing everything up for. And sometimes we'll get some announcements here and there, but sometimes we'll get some trailers coming out, but not really anything else that kind of will come out with it. We'll hear more about the news of the footage that's aired than actually seeing it actually come out. Sometimes we'll get a trailer or two that appears online as well, but mostly it's footage that is just exclusively screened in the auditorium, and then they do have press there, so they're able to kind of tweet out, post online for all the stuff that was able to come out. And so last night was kind of the opening ceremony, the kickoff for CinemaCon, and it was, as they usually kind of do, it's kind of tradition at this point, it was the Sony Pictures panel that was able to go up first, and they were just kind of going into all the films that they are shooting now that are going to be prepped and ready for 2023, and some things that are going to be coming out that we didn't really know anything about, but hearing about it really kind of, I think, piqued a lot of people's interest. So they kicked everything off with talking about Bad Boys 4, which is, I think, going to be coming out probably next year around, maybe a little bit later, but as of right now, it is in its fourth week of shooting, and so they kind of introduced the panel and the executives that were going to be kind of there screening and pitching everything to the theater owners, and then they kind of went into the rest of the slate for what they have coming out. So some of the stuff that really kind of stood out to me, I'm not going to go by a full panel by panel recap of everything, but from everything that I heard, the stuff that really kind of stuck out to me, it was a film from Sony that's coming out later this year called Dumb Money, which is directed by Greg Gillespie, who did films and shows like I, Tonya, Cruella a few years ago. He also was the director on the first few episodes of Pam and Tommy. He very much has kind of a tongue-in-cheek style to his movies, and even though sometimes they can play a little serious, it does have a lighter effect to them, and it sounds like this film very much is going to have that. From the sounds of it, it is about it is based off of the true story about all the crazy stuff that happened with the GameStop stock back in 2021, and even where it helped kind of elevate AMC a little bit, and these kind of guys on Reddit really kind of broke the stock market in a way and really put a lot of millions of dollars in jeopardy for a lot of people. And it has an amazing cast that includes the like of someone like a Paul Dano. So hearing some of that footage sounded really interesting to me, and some people were comparing it to The Big Short, and from everything that I heard about the film, it very much seems like it is Greg Gillespie's Big Short in a way. So I'm actually really excited to see that film and hearing about it. It sounded really, really good. So I'm excited to see a trailer when it actually does come out. We also, one of the big ones, of course, when you think about Sony, you think about Spider-Man, and of course their big film this year really for Sony is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which is their sequel to their hit Academy Award-winning film, which came out in 2018, which was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. So it seems like they showed about 14 more minutes of new footage that I've heard great things about. It seems like they really kind of placated to more of the emotion of the film, kind of detailing more of Gwen and Miles's relationship along with Miles and his mother. And so it seems like they really have a good idea for what their handle is on this story. And so I'm excited to see when it hits on June 2nd. And I think they realize how big that film could really do for them as well. The one thing that really stuck out to me, and the one thing that I took away from the Sony Pictures panel that really piqued my interest, that actually got me really excited for something that I wasn't excited about before, is this new Sony Marvel spinoff film that's coming out in the vein of Venom and Morbius, is this Kraven the Hunter film, which is starring Aaron Taylor Johnson. It's with Ariana DeBoe, Russell Crowe, Alexandria Navarro. It's got an incredible cast, and somehow Sony with these Marvel spinoff films have been able to corral great casts together. And one of the big ones is this Madame Web film that has this impeccable cast, which I'm really interested to see what they have that was able to get them to sign on. And the same thing with this film, when you have really good, talented people and even an Academy Award winner in someone like a Russell Crowe and also an Ariana DeBoe, what pitch could you have given them that wants them to sign on to this movie? And from everything that I heard and everything that kind of shocked me is that apparently this Kraven the Hunter film is going to be a very down-to-earth, gritty film, and apparently it's going to be and follow in the same vein as some DC films, as some of the kind of X-Men films like Deadpool and Logan. It's going to be the first ever Sony comic book R-rated movie, and hearing about some of the footage where it seems like Aaron Kraven bites a person's nose off and just hunts people down in these kind of animalistic ways, it gets me pumped up, and I can't wait to see footage from this thing. But now all of a sudden, when you add in those elements where it's going to be gory, gritty, R, down to earth, you've piqued my interest a little bit. And then, of course, it sounds like the Rhino is going to be a part of this, and it sounds like it's going to be kind of dealing with mutation a little bit, where it seems like you can transform into some kind of animals, I guess, and that's how the Rhino is going to be included in this film. But it sounds really interesting to me, actually. I was really surprised when I heard about the footage, I heard about the details, and not even seeing anything, I was like, okay, I'm in. I'm interested. You have my attention now, Kraven. And so I'm excited to see this. And hearing about this film and what they're going for, I could see Aaron Taylor Johnson wanting to do this film. So this could be a leg up for him when it comes to maybe getting James Bond, maybe not, but I'm really intrigued by seeing a trailer for this film now and actually experiencing this film out when it does come out next year. Another one that was kind of talked about was this new Sydney Sweeney, Glenn Powell rom-com that just kind of finished up wrapping. They said last night that it just finished up wrapping, that they just came from Australia, and we've seen kind of set pictures and whatnot from the film, so that one seems like it's going to be on the way. It's titled Anyone But You. Didn't really, the footage sounded like you would with a typical R-rated rom-com a little bit. It stars two beautiful looking people in Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney, and it's going to be a testament to, I think, them, of what their star power really is, especially for Glenn Powell coming off of Top Gun Maverick. How big is his profile now as a leading man? And same thing with Sydney Sweeney, where other than really Zendaya, she's been the one that's really kind of popped off with stardom when it comes to the Euphoria kind of momentum. But whereas with Zendaya, she's proven herself to be, I think, a star where she's been in a bunch of things and you know what she can do and you know the markability for her. We really don't know that with Sydney Sweeney. She's been linked to a dozen projects since the second season of Euphoria came out, but really none of them have kind of appeared. She's been filming and producing and shooting all this stuff, but we haven't really seen it. So we don't really know the results yet of her stardom, or is she one of these next big stars to come, where if you put her in a film, people will go because it's Sydney Sweeney. And so I think this is going to be one of those films that tests that out, but sounds like it's going to be an interesting rom-com to check out from the footage. that came out. There was an announcement that Ghostbusters Afterlife sequel is filming right now. It's apparently Paul Rudd, Carrie Coon are in the Ghostbusters attire. They're going to be a part of the members now, and it's filming in the firehouse. It's going to be returning to New York City. So it sounds really interesting, and I'm excited for it. The other thing that really got me excited was, of course, The Equalizer 3, which alongside debuting a trailer for that and new footage, Denzel Washington got the Lifetime Achievement Award from CinemaCon, which is really cool to see. He kind of thanked theater owners for kind of staying in the business that they are, and without them, they wouldn't be where they are. And he's kind of true in that way. But what really kind of stood out to me was hearing about this footage from The Equalizer 3, but then seeing that footage when it came out earlier this morning was awesome. And I've been somebody who is a huge Equalizer fan. I really enjoyed the first two films with Denzel that came out. I was happy to hear that both he and Antoine Fuqua were coming back for one final run, and it looks great. I mean, the basic synopsis for this film is it's Denzel Washington versus the Italian mafia in Italy. And for me, that's all you need in terms of synopsis to get people, I think, excited for this film. I think Denzel is just a great actor. He's somebody who I feel like people forget that he can actually be an action star. Like, he's been in action thriller films before, clearly with these films with Equalizer, but Man on Fire, which is going to be a reunion between him and Dakota Fanning in this movie, Equalizer 3. They'll be reuniting after almost 20 years since sharing the screen when she was just a little girl, and he was one of the biggest stars in the planet at that time period when Man on Fire came out. So I think seeing all that was great. The action looks awesome. It looks just gritty. I mean, there's been some cool action sequences within the first two Equalizer films, but some of the stuff that Antoine Fuqua and all of them are doing in this film are like brutal, and I'm excited to see how it's all going to go down. I think September 1st is a perfect date for this film. It's literally the transition between summer and fall, and it's not too big, it's not too small of a film. It's that right kind of mid-level budget, maybe a little bit of a higher mid-level budget film that people can go check out, be excited for, and get you ready for that fall season a little bit. So I think it's the right release date for the film, the right for Labor Day weekend for people that might want to go check it out, and we'll see how it goes. But I think this one is gonna hit the sweet spot when it comes to some of these action films, so I'm excited about that. And then they wrapped it all up with, I think, a really interesting first look at Napoleon. I think it was really big in the fact that with CinemaCon, it's about theater owners and the theatrical experience, and now with the reports about Apple and Amazon putting more money into going exclusively theatrical first and then their streaming service, Apple was one of the first ones kind of right out of the gate to kind of say, we're partnering, Sony's partnering with Apple on putting out and releasing their film Napoleon, which is directed by Ridley Scott, and reuniting him with Joaquin Phoenix when they did Gladiator all those years ago. And it's another big epic film, and from the sounds of it, from the footage that they saw, it seems like they showed a big epic battle sequence which kind of features the strategical smarts of Napoleon, and it sounds really interesting, and I wouldn't be shocked if it's one that is very much in the awards conversation given its release date. It sounds like it is right up there. So there was a lot of stuff that came from the Sony panel that really kind of piqued my interest, but the ones that I really took a lot away from that really got me excited was really kind of specifically two things. It was the Kraven the Hunter material that sounded great. The fact that it's rated R, it's gritty, it's violent. I'm really actually excited about that now and can't wait to see actual footage from it. And then the Equalizer 3 stuff looked amazing and looks so cool. Again, love the first two films. Excited to see what they're going to do with this final chapter. So those are really the two things that stood out to me. And of course, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, I know the greatness that film is going to probably exude come June 2nd. So that didn't shock me all that much. I'm already excited for that. But Kraven, Equalizer 3 are the ones that really got me excited and piqued my interest. So what did you guys think about this Sony Pictures panel? What are you guys excited about from all these Sony announcements and footage and movies that they showcase? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And again, over the next couple of days, I will be kind of recapping the other panels. Again, Warner Brothers just had their panel today, so at the time of this recording, they just finished up. So either Wednesday or Thursday, along with what I think Disney is going to be doing tomorrow, I'll either recap it on Thursday or I'll recap Disney and Warner Brothers tomorrow. So one of the two, I'll either recap Wednesday and Thursday and then kind of wrap it all up at the end of the weekend, with Paramount also having their panel as well. So it's going to be a CinemaCon kind of week for the Sam Bassell podcast. We'll have it all here for you on this podcast and on this show. But until then, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out the amazing content that I have on my channel. You can check me out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, SoundCloud, and much more. Also, make sure to tune into the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And be sure to check out the other amazing shows that are on here, such as You Mad Bro, the number one source of what the internet is pissed off about on a weekly basis. Also, make sure to check out Goal Driven Professionals, geared toward improving client relations, return on investment, and customer acquisition costs for independent businesses and services. Also, make sure to check out The Daily Grind, a weekly motivational podcast with Kelly Johnson, giving you everyday tips and key takeaways on reaching your goals. Also, along the way, make sure to check out these other amazing shows on the Podcast Solutions, such as WrestleAct Radio, WrestleMania Podcast, and Midnight Showing. You can check these out and so much more on the website, ambiguouspodcastsolutions.com. Also on Facebook and Twitter at RealAmbiguous. And if you want to check out Canopy Treehouse, use the coupon code AMBIGUOUS. Also, when you get a chance, make sure to follow me on social media. You can find me on Twitter at Bassell Samuel. That's BUSSELLSAMUEL. And also on Facebook at Sam Bassell. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, keep on screening.